good afternoon, good morning, or wherever you're listening to podcasts. And welcome to The Substation, Energy Economics Explained. My name is Tom Edwards, and I'm joined by
Emma Burns.
And we're here to talk to you about data in the wholesale market. What's the wholesale market, Emma?
Fundamentally, the wholesale market is about trading between generators on the one hand who produce the energy and retailers or suppliers on the other hand who deliver that energy to us consumers. And fundamentally, trading in the wholesale market is doing that kind of heavy lifting of matching kind of what consumers want or will want in a given half hour and what's being produced.
You had it. I like your. You told me before that it was about coordination.
Yeah, I think that fundamentally that's it, isn't it? It's about kind of coordinating supply and demand at a fundamental level, and that coordinating role happens sort of years ahead, right up to real time, is when the wholesale market typically finishes. So it differs in different markets, but really, yeah, it's kind of doing that coordination role. It's through the wholesale market and through trading in the wholesale market that that coordination is sort of finessed closer to real time as we have better information about what the weather will do, what demand will do. And that's really what we're talking about in terms of the wholesale market.
So when we say market, the thing that springs to my mind is prices. And when people say, oh, energy prices are going up this year, or Ofgem has raised the cap, is this what we're talking about?
I mean, broadly. And I think that's the really interesting thing about the wholesale market is there is no price, right? And I think that's often a bit of a misconception in the wholesale market. People will talk about the wholesale price. But really, when we're talking about trading in the wholesale market, it's always a series of different prices, isn't it? So it's all about when you choose to trade and what's the view of prices then. And, have things changed closer to real time.
You're talking about the mysterious hedge here, aren't you?
Well, exactly. I mean, typically, that's what, the energy supplier, the retailer is trying to do. It's sort of, considering energy prices overall and how best to hedge the risk of being exposed to very, very high prices in real time. And doing that by kind of forward contracting.
Do we actually know why it's called hedging? Like, I presume it doesn't have anything to do with topiary or, bucolic countryside lanes.
I'm happy to give a hot take on this and say, by hedging, you're neither here nor there. You've got one foot on one garden and the other in the other.
I get it.
So is that it? Is it? And because you're kind of saying, we're not sure prices could go up, could go down. So we'll sort of,
Is it safe to admit at 30-something years of age that I guess I didn't realise when someone said they were hedging their bets, it meant that they were on both sides of the hedge?
I'm not sure, is that an actual hedge? Or where that original term comes from, and was there an actual hedge involved in that case?
Well, I guess it's because traders couldn't go around saying they were fencing because that would make it sound too exciting and like swordy and dashing and pirates and stuff.
This is true. So they wanted to go for a more gardening vibe just to make it a bit less exciting, yeah. I suppose.
You tell the the boss that, oh yeah, I'm just hedging.
Yeah, don't worry about this. This is not exciting. But yeah, I mean, that's a large part of what trading in the wholesale market is sort of trying to do, right? Because electricity is such that the price does vary quite a lot, just like other markets. But because, most consumers don't have elastic demand, we can't see the price day ahead typically and say, no, that's too much. I don't want to be charged that. We don't have that ability yet. And, in future we will. So instead, the retailer plays that or the supplier plays that important role for us and sort of, I suppose, protects us from the really high price spikes by, going to market and maybe paying a bit of a premium overall, or I guess you pay a slight premium based on what your expectation would be to get that energy locked in, I suppose, in advance and get that price locked in. It's a really important kind of risk management sort of strategy, sort of for the market, but also for on behalf of consumers ultimately is the role of that hedge. So yeah, I think the other interesting thing about wholesale markets is, I suppose, just thinking about why people trade at all.
Why can't I just go and buy a barrel of electricity? Oh, there was a really good story. I think it was in Bloomberg about somebody who literally tried to buy a barrel of oil, and they went rang around all the trading desks, and they were like, no, "We don't deal with the physical actual stuff. No, like that's you can't just buy oil. It's dangerous." I think they eventually like they gave somebody some money, and they went away and came back with like a glass full of crude, and they're like, "That's the best I can do."
There is, I can imagine people would have quite a romantic idea about what they could do with the barrel as well. I don't know, it could become a piece of furniture maybe, or you could possibly brew whiskey in it or something. Yeah, I mean, so this is the reason why we have suppliers, right? This is why we have retailers, and they do that buying on our behalf. They buy those megawatt hours. They're arguably much better placed than the likes of you and me, and their traders are much better skilled. Yeah, so they do that kind of risk management thing. I think the really interesting thing, well, certainly when it comes to data in the wholesale market, the interesting thing from my perspective is all about price formation. And I guess where does that price formation come at different points and what's ultimately driving that? Which is when we have to come on to my absolutely favorite topic, which is imbalance pricing. I believe you're also a fan.
Yes, somewhat. Possibly to the extent that if you search imbalance pricing on Twitter, it'll probably be me you find.
But yeah, it's I think the relationship that I have with imbalance pricing, it's fair to say it's quite love hate. I mean, I love it because it's absolutely bonkers. But I don't necessarily think it's the most efficient or sensible set of arrangements, and I like efficiency and sensible things. So, but
Let's not open the can of worms on imbalance pricing too far, perhaps a small entree of worms.
I don't want to fall into that can head first with my feet in the air, but yeah, I suppose what key to the wholesale market is this idea of imbalance, and what that means is you are incentivized, so you're through these imbalance prices to balance your contractual position, so your wholesale position and your physical position. So that means that there's incentives to make sure, so say for a supplier, that you are forecasting your customer's demand and what they're physically going to consume for a given half hour, and you're going to the market and you're procuring that energy. So you're contracting with a generator or a demand side response or other flexibility provider in a number of different ways. You're bringing that generation comes on, it's scheduled on as a result of your trade, and as a result of that trade matching what your customers have consumed, you are in balance. So that's the whole kind of concept of kind of balancing your wholesale position and your physical position. And really, that's what drives trading. That's why people trade, is this idea that if you are not in balance, if you're out of balance, that you could be exposed to what's effectively a penalty, or at least, not a good price for that. And fundamentally, when we talk about wholesale trading, when we talk about wholesale prices, it's that expectation or it's that risk of being out of balance, which is what is driving trading in all the different time frames before that.
A wiser person than me once told me that it's the reason you trade is because if you don't trade, grid will do it for you and they won't get a good price and you won't like the price they pay
That's
and
a
they'll
good way
make
to
you
put
pay.
it. And I mean, not to badmouth National Grid's trading abilities.
Well, the price isn't going to be great. It's the whole thing has been set up so that they can't get a good price. So they're the ones left holding the bag at the end of the day. The only option left to them to buy. So theoretically, say I've been a good supplier and I've gone and bought all of my power. I've bought it at the best possible price, the best generators, the most efficient ones, what the market was trading at. If you leave it to the last minute, the only thing left is the dogged old gas turbine down the back of the sofa.
I mean, that's part of it. But there is also this sort of interesting kind of theoretical or philosophical debate about, should people be allowed to be in balance, or should people be incentivized to be in balance, or should there be penalties, if you're not in balance? The definition of what the market is maybe separate to data. I suppose data kind of flows on from that. So yeah, there's the question about geography. There's the question about kind of duration would be the other kind of key dimension in my mind about market design is, you know, what is the settlement period? So in the wholesale market, we talk about the settlement period being this, you know, 30-minute period. And effectively, that's the product. That's what we're trading. That's the homogenous tradable product that we buy and sell through contracts and through exchanges in the wholesale market.
That's so just to get this clear in my mind, that's when, say, for example, I own a generator and I would be selling into the wholesale, or at least I'm settled. Sorry, mm-hmm. My meter read is between two points. It's at the start of the half hour and at the end of the half hour. And the difference in megawatts divided by the amount of time is the megawatt hours I've provided. And that's what I'm selling.
Exactly.
Into the wholesale market. So
it's kind of, yeah, the overall measurement across that 30-minute period in GB currently. But other markets do it differently, right? So, you know, 15 minutes, I think, would probably be... Is that the most common?
It's I think it's the standard the European single market is moving towards. What else is there? There's...
Australia.
5 minutes. Oh, they've just moved to that, actually, haven't they? Because they were on 30 and they've moved to 5.
It's the way of the future, right? So I suppose historically, when we had, you know, less intermittency, probably more predictability of demand, you know, the 30-minute...
This is a data point as well, though. Like, this is an important data and technology point, is that our meters, upon which most of the industry was built, so if you're looking back into the 90s and 80s and stuff like that, the registers on this equipment could read every half hour, and you could just about trust that you could get a person to download the data or read the data off the register enough times that half an hour was okay. And now we can communicate instantly and send the data off to a server. We don't need to send a person around. The register doesn't necessarily have to be on the meter. So why can't we have 5 minutes?
Why do we want that in the first place, right? So, like, why is 30 minutes not good enough?
So I guess on my view would be that there's two, three. So there's some technologies that would benefit from having more granular settlements. So, for example, demand-side response, electric vehicles, battery storage, stuff that can react very quickly and is good at providing, you know, has really high ramp rates. So if they can respond to a signal that's happening very quickly, then they'll be able to outcompete a gas turbine or a hydro station or a wind farm, which have, you know, large physical components that require speeding up or slowing down. Whereas a, you know, DSR, I can turn off my HVAC, or I can, with a battery, you know, export power, import power. So those parties, technologies with practically no ramp time, they're going to be better off in a world where settlement is as close to real time as possible.
And from a global perspective, I guess, from an end consumer perspective, shorter is better because there is just that natural variability, I suppose, in terms of customer demand, but also in terms of generation if there's intermittency. So we want to be able to sort of, I guess, capture that value or reflect that value of those shorter term, faster acting assets by having that shorter term, shorter settlement period.
Yeah, you could trade. So, for example, if you had a 5 minute or a 1 minute, whatever settlement period, I could be trading for cooking dinner. Because, you know, depending on what I'm cooking, that can range in a fair amount of time. So if I'm using my electric hob to do a stir fry or something, that's like 20 minutes. Well, shorter than shorter than the settlement period. And actually, how much of that is actually frying on the wok or whatever. So, yeah, perhaps I could trade for specific activities I'm doing, which may be more interesting to, say, industrial or commercial users who are thinking more about processes. Rather than, I mean, I think it does sound a bit dystopian to trade for cooking dinner, but that's why I, you know, hedging so that if we're all doing it at the same time and it comes back around in circles, doesn't it?
That's it though, right? Your supplier is doing that or should be doing that on your behalf, right? Your supplier is your kind of intermediary in the market. And then I guess with the 30-minute settlement period, we're losing out on the kind of spikes, I guess, presumably that are less than 30 minutes, you know, that are caused by the dinner or the walk for 12 minutes or whatever it is. And because we don't have that reflected in the wholesale market through the settlement period, that means the wholesale market can never really manage that. The wholesale market is not placed, you know, or incentivized to be thinking about you and your walk. It's just thinking about, well, okay, yeah, maybe he was doing the walk for the first 12 minutes, but then the next 12 minutes he turned all the lights off, and overall his demand was, you know, whatever it was in the middle. So we're kind of missing out
Yeah,
on that kind
there could
of.
be products or business models out there that could deliver for me cooking my dinner, and we won't know because we don't measure the cooking of my dinner.
Exactly. And also then the implication of the supplier and you not being able to kind of manage that is National Grid needs to. So the less that you let the market do, either through settlement periods or whatever, or gate closures, or there's other levers, right? Or locational signals, for example, the less you let the market do or the wholesale market do, then the more National Grid or the TSO, you know, the transmission system operator needs to do.
And of course, if we record that data, it becomes available for all the suppliers so that they can look at portfolios of stuff and work out, you know, can I offer a product to this person because they appear to have some sort of demand spike at 1 a.m. in the morning or whatever, from when they're operating their arc welder. Perhaps we can offer them a special tariff just for them.
So, I mean, I think that the main thing for me when I think about data in, well, I suppose energy in the wholesale market more generally is meters and sort of the role, you know, they sit kind of at both ends, right? Like the start, you know, when the energy is being produced, that's how we measure it from a generator or another source of energy. And then right at the end in our homes, our meters kind of measure what we're consuming. And it's, you know, really that the role of meters is to create the product. Like it is kind of, it, you know, the meters plus sort of the rules that support them are effectively what allows us to trade a thing that doesn't really physically exist. You know, we can't grasp it, we can't stick it in the barrel like we can oil.
And the energy industry doesn't think of you as a person or a household or a family. It thinks of you as a meter. That's what you are.
Meters are probably the most ill misunderstood, and people think meters aren't exciting, and arguably they're not. But I think they are. I mean, they're fundamental, they're central, and I think, you know, you've talked about the generation meters there, and historically that's kind of what we've relied on increasingly, and I think we'll talk about this more in a future episode, you know, the role of retail meters, you know, what's really going on the ground is going to be much bigger, and hopefully strengthened in the market.
And I guess the other thing, bringing us back to the data and, you know, tech lens and focus, is that at least in my house, the meter is probably early 90s vintage. And, you know, my smartphone, my computer, the Nintendo Switch all monitor their own energy consumption and all of that sort of stuff. And I can get really cool charts of what, you know, the battery life and all that sort of stuff about my energy consumption on my phone and on my computer, but I can't do it about my house. Like the meter hasn't moved in the same way that all of my consumer electronics has. And that's, I think, a fundamental point for thinking about data in the future, is that we should realistically expect that we can apply all of the cool stuff that's happened in semiconductors and memory storage and batteries and communications to this very, as you say, fundamental part of the energy
Yeah,
industry.
you can see a world where almost, yeah, the smart meter infrastructure that we have, the meters that we have in our homes are almost kind of leapfrogged by all the really cool, whizzy, and let's face it, kind of cheap tech that's out there that can provide those, yeah, the measurement and those insights. And I think increasingly going forward, you know, at the moment, trading in the wholesale market is kind of just about, it's about measurement and it's about information and insight. It's not really about control as much. I suspect in the future, when we do have, you know, the smart appliances capable of responding in real time, and the EV, and also, you know, changing market design and etc. to support that, you know, but what we'll be talking about really is assets responding and assets reacting and being controlled, which is quite exciting, really. So we've talked about why we trade, which, yeah, all about consumer demand, avoiding imbalance. Let's talk a little bit more about how we trade. I guess we'll focus in a bit on GB here, specifically, because, you know, not all markets are the same, not all market designs are the same. But we talked about the role of imbalance and the imbalance price, and, you know, that's the kind of the penalty, or that's the default price of energy. But really, most of the action happens before then, right? So it's all about kind of the ex-ante markets, the forward markets, you know, from years ahead all the way up sort of to close to real time, going into the market and sort of, yeah, you trying to sort of reach a price, strike a deal, hedge a price that's acceptable to both parties. So, you know, longer term, that might be bilateral contracts, so generators and suppliers. I always think about them meeting in a smoky room. I'm sure there's no smoky room anymore, but it's more, I guess it's more about the bilateral relationship, right? Like, it's I'm Emma, the generator, and you're Tom, the supplier, and we know each other, and we'll have a long-term bilateral contract probably.
The trading desks of say Emma Co and Tom Co will have a grid trade master agreement between each other so that I can phone you up and say, do you have 10 megawatt hours for 6 p.m. tonight? And you can go, your trading desk can look at the wider market and go, yeah, we think it's worth this to work up a price, and we can just agree, like phone call to phone call.
So I'll be like, "Hey Tom, give me a barrel of megawatts. What's the going rate for a barrel?" Is that how it
Yeah, pretty much that's how I understand the bilateral trading to workers.
Do you have a punnet?
Yeah, a punnet.
Can I get a barrel and a punnet of megawatts, please? Megawatt
Punnet
hours.
of your finest vaults,
Yeah,
please.
just the good ones, though. So that happens. Yeah, I guess that's the kind of longer term, and that could be, you know, so we might have a deal where I'd sell you my energy for 10 years or 2 years or what have you, and I suppose you lock in a certain amount. Both parties would want to lock in a certain amount, kind
Well,
of years
you get
ahead.
into power purchase agreement kind of territory there. So that's where you might lock in those long-term deals. So for example, I built a solar farm and you're going to pay me £50 a megawatt hour for 10 years for the next, for every megawatt hour that comes out of it.
Yeah, so power purchase agreement, yeah, it's effectively that, isn't it? It's a bilateral long-term contract. And I suppose even further along the spectrum then is, you know, you might buy a generator, and that's, I suppose, vertical integration. That's the most
That's one
extreme.
strategy, yeah.
It's contracting extreme, isn't it, really, when you just buy the whole thing.
You're contracting with Siemens then in that case, or GE or Alstom, whoever's left in the turbine making business.
True. Yeah. Exactly. Of course. So yeah, so it's bilateral trading, and then I suppose as we get closer to real time, you know, it's all about, well, we've got better visibility about what might be happening, what our consumers might be consuming, so we can make better informed decisions and we adjust our position. You know, we.
So you're talking about shaping and delta hedging.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So shaping is about working out what kind of consumers you have and what they might be using when, and trying to buy the right appropriate amount of power. And then delta hedging is about taking those prices as they, you know, maybe your bilateral contracts or your longer future data contracts, and maybe looking at other markets as well, like gas and carbon, and trying to basically make money out of the position you've already got. So, for example, if I've already bought a position and that position I could sell out of it, the price has fallen. So I could sell out of that position and maybe buy another position and still make some money on that deal all the way through because I can buy or sell at different prices. So that's the idea of delta hedging, is basically taking positions you've already got and trying to get just to keep making money out of it, basically. It means that kind of trying saying that. Saying that I bought this power for this much money or that the whole, that, you know, people can point to the price of the day ahead market and say prices are an next year high, but realistically your supplier has not paid that price because their trading desk will have bought over a range of baskets, and the position that they have has been has changed multiple times since they bought that power, if they are savvy and smart.
Well, I mean, that goes both ways as well, right? You can hedge in a world where prices are rising, you hedge in advance and you're in a better position. But in a world where prices are falling, you hedge in advance and you're in a worse position, which is obviously, you know, what we've seen, well, in the context of the British market, we've seen a lot of small suppliers historically come in kind of benefiting from that context of falling prices.
A broker is where I go to get power, usually on shorter timescales than kind of years ahead. So you might be looking at, you know, brokerages like ICE, LIBA, which is the Energy Brokers Association, where you can say, I want 10 megawatt hours, or I have 10 megawatt hours to sell, but I don't necessarily know who the counterparty is, or this broker puts me in touch with a counterparty that I don't necessarily have a direct bilateral relationship with. So actually I have a relationship with the broker, and the broker tells me that they've got party Y over here who want that power, and they can sit in the middle and arrange the contract between us.
And it's all presumably anonymous, or not necessarily?
It can be and it cannot be. It depends. You choose your broker based on whether or not you wanted it to be.
And I guess the benefit here is you're getting closer to real time. There's maybe less buyers and sellers available, so people want to kind of pool their liquidity.
Yeah, and it's easier to contract with the broker than it is with, you know, have a relationship with every trading desk in the whole industry.
That's a lot of smoky rooms to be hanging out in. I think then the other interesting, well, the next piece then of the trading puzzle is the role of exchanges. So, you know, where you've got an auction, you know, that is, or an algorithm that's determining the what the price should be, and the same price is paid to everybody. So, you know, when you're in a world of bilateral trading or broker or continuous trading, you know, the price that you pay or are paid is the price that you agree in that specific deal. But exchanges are different, aren't they? So it's more about, you know, what is the single price that's paid to everybody? What's the clearing price for that auction?
Yeah, I put in my bid or an offer into the auction, and the algorithm matches me with all the other participants. It, you know, it swirls around in a big pool, and I'm now anonymous, and my counterparty is anonymous. If I go to an exchange at an auction or an exchange, such for example APX or N2EX, I won't know who my counterparty is.
Exactly. And but the real benefit here is, you know, we're kind of pooling all this energy, and, you know, we have, well, again, in GB and in the European market at the day ahead stage, there's this really key auction that is used to, well, it schedules, you know, trades between different countries, but also just more generally, even on a local level, you know, most generators, most suppliers would look to this day ahead market. You know, they might, what's called gross bidding. So they could often put all of their volumes into the day ahead market. And the purpose of that market then is to almost coordinate and re-optimize things at that kind of closer to real time stage. And sort of, yeah, spit out effectively what the best, you know, most optimal position is from the market's perspective, but also the system's perspective. And that day ahead, well, the day ahead market has, you know, a number of interesting kind of interactions or uses. I suppose because it's such a liquid exchange or auction, and because you know, there's quite a lot of price certainty associated with that. You know, when you have a lot of participants in an auction, you know, you kind
it's
of
a good trust, price.
Yeah, it's a good price. You trust the price coming.
It's not like the futures that you might see on the brokerages, where maybe occasionally someone might buy that. You know, someone bought at that price.
Exactly. Yeah, there's enough buying and selling going on to know that you, yeah, it's a real price. And also, I guess it's the time at which that auction is happening. So you know a lot more day ahead than you do 2 years ahead. So it's a good point for the market to sort of re-optimize. And I guess there's also then the role of European regulations here, which underpins that role of that day ahead market and the role of that kind of coordinating algorithm, sort of facilitated by that day ahead market, which schedules energy and, flows all across.
It's also used as an important reference price. So, for example, the power purchase agreements that we talked about before will often reference the day ahead because they think, okay, we know that that's a well-traded liquid market and it's a good reference price, so we'll use it. The GB contracts for difference reference it for intermittent generators. I presume there are other...
I mean, bilateral contracts more generally. Any kind of financial trading that would happen in electricity or related to electricity, you'd expect to have...
Which means you need to trade on the day ahead. Especially if you're a wind... If you're a renewable generator, you need to trade on the day ahead because so much of your business is tied to that through contractual, either government contractuals or power purchase arrangements.
So when I worked at Ofgem, there was a lot of interest in this question of wholesale market liquidity at different stages. So, you know, are enough people trading that people can trust prices?
Do we need to explain liquidity, or are we going to take that as a...
effectively by liquidity, we mean that there is a large number of people buying and selling. So there's enough people buying and selling that you can, you know, rely on prices. You know, it's not Emma and Tom in a smoky room. It's
someone will buy what you're selling, or someone is selling what you want to buy.
Yeah, exactly. You can be certain that there is a market there when there's a liquid market. Yeah, liquidity means, you can be certain of buying, you can be certain of selling, and you can also then be certain of the prices coming out of that. So if you had a market that isn't liquid, and it is just Emma and Tom, you know, we would enjoy a degree of market power, effectively. We could probably set the price at whatever we wanted.
It would be difficult to break into the relationship. For example, I could withhold power from a new participant if I only wanted to sell it to you, that kind of...
Exactly, yeah, the kind of, the barriers to entry are much higher in that. Where you have a liquid market, the barriers to entry are lower. People can kind of access the products, yeah. They can get involved, exactly.
Electricity's never been the most liquid commodity because, for a start, it's not real, or it's not physical. The further out the trading isn't as good as it's, we've said that the day ahead is relatively liquid, but even compared to gas, it's not great. It's better than it was, I suppose, which is a good thing. But you can't necessarily trade out very far or with any certainty or get a view on what the power price might be in 5 years' time, which, you know, you can do with oil. I'm not sure there are many people trading electricity out for 5 years unless it's part of a PPA, a power purchase arrangement. And even then, it will probably be referenced in some way to day-ahead auctions. So is there an issue with, how do I access a price? How can we make those markets more liquid? Can I trust them? There's also then... who's trading what? So it's difficult to understand what the relationship is between a retail tariff and what the wholesale price is. So I guess if you are an engaged consumer who wants, you know, cool, whizzy gadgets that can do stuff, or you've got a heat pump and a solar panel and an EV and a home battery, how do I relate what the price of power is to what I can do with my stuff? And anyway, I can't measure it to the extent that, the wholesale market will not settle me to the extent that I can actually take advantage of what I can do with my kit. There is a problem here. And that's maybe where suppliers come in. Do they become mini exchanges on their own? Because there's no way I'm going to be able to pay the 20. So, for example, if I do have all of that kit and I put in a half hourly meter and I register with the Balsier settlement code and pay my £250 a month and my £500 annual subscription fee, I then, on top of that, have to pay the 20 grand, I think it is, for an annual fee to access one of the auction platforms for my 4 kilowatt panel and my 10 kilowatt hour battery.
This is the world where you're going full Tomco. You're setting up, instead of you're kind of emancipating yourself from your energy supplier and you're trying to set up your own trader, is it?
Well, yeah, so if I wanted to trade, I mean, these are the barriers, you know, this is what I would have to jump through. A, I'd have to get a half hourly meter, so oh boy, that's going to cost me £250, I think, just alone for the kit. And then I have to have a meter reading agent. I could become that myself, I suppose. But that's a couple of... I have to go through the qualification process. Oh boy. And then I've got to pay all these other charges to become an entity in the energy market. So I think the only real way for me to then actually trade power is to find a third party who's already done this, and, you know, where there are economies of scale, because as with everything in life, the more of it you can do, the cheaper it becomes. So if my supplier, who's actually supplying, you know, 20 to 30,000 people like me, can provide me that platform through which I can access the wholesale markets, that's the key. But then the wholesale markets, again, I still can't trade in a timescale that's helpful to my asset. Because my problems are going to be around hedging my use of a shower or the hot water heater and that kind of stuff. Can I trade for that? Is there a reference price for that time ahead? Once you get into the within-day stuff, the liquidity falls down again. So once you've done the day ahead, that's when most people are trading. It then reduces as you get closer and closer to real time. But I might change my mind about when I want to have a shower or cook or whatever. So if I need to re-dispatch everything, will there be a available price? And how do I access that?
I mean, to me, this is the heart of the wholesale market design question, right? Is like, how do you create that real-time market and that real-time price and that real-time signal, or very, very, very close to real-time? Because, you know, it's all well and good to be able to optimize at the day-ahead stage or, you know, hours ahead or even 1 hour ahead. But, you know, consumers are consumers. They're mad and irrational, and, you know, weather is weather. Also mad and irrational. So inherently, we're always going to need that real-time coordinating function. Ideally, we'll see the wholesale market expand in future to be able to provide that.
I think there is a role for... we talked a bit about machine learning and algorithms last time. Obviously, we're going to talk a lot about machine learning and algorithms. But while we are mad and irrational, we're also relatively predictable on an aggregate basis. So I tend to have dinner at around the same time of around the same kind of meal. I tend to have the shower at the same time each day. You know, I tend to start work at roughly the same time. If my personal assistant or, you know, home smart hub or whatever can look at all of my past data, so getting back into the metering stuff, and if it can work out, hey, he usually has a shower at about this time every Friday or wherever, perhaps I should buy just once a week. Perhaps I should buy him some power at this time. And then
the wholesale market should be driving those longer term signals. So even if trading is only within, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, maybe longer with PPAs, there's still that interaction between that kind of shorter time term frame and the longer term investment time frame. So, you know, ultimately we want people to build the battery or what have you to be able to satisfy the energy demand of your shower, your weekly shower, your weekly shower and your midnight walk session, I think. Was it a 2 a.m. walk you were talking about earlier? As you mentioned, you know, the 30-minute settlement period, that's fairly blunt. you know, especially in the future world when we've got heat pumps and walks and all kinds of things happening. We need to make sure that, that the measurement assets or the metering assets
so the,
can translate into value.
So it's not just the measurement, it's the settlement, which we should get printed on a t-shirt probably. It's not just measurement, it's settlement. Because it's all well and good measuring you. What we're not doing is moving the data and the cash around that would enable the behaviors to be incentivized.
What,
that we want.
How are we creating the incentives? How are we creating the right incentives? And that's through cash and it's through settlement. And that's the question for another day.
So then we're getting into, we can't have the energy and data explosion, energy and tech explosion in this industry until we sort out settlement. Is that our big?
Is that the hot take for this session?
Is that a hot take?
Not that hot. And, but fundamentally yes. And I suppose you and I are both also part of this overall infrastructure, right? Like we help make the decisions and drive the market rules and make changes to them. And you know, it is very very slow moving, but it is often the barrier to a lot of really really cool things that could be possible. At the end of the day, is there will always need to be that single centralized function, and until we, well, you know, as long as that's the case, the rules are inherently going to be fairly prescriptive. Now that said, I think we're both quite keen that the rule process can change and how quickly we can make rule changes and how much we can accommodate this innovation and new technology. We really hope that that improves. But as you say, it is about kind of working within the existing framework rather than, I suppose, throwing it all out and starting again.
Yeah, and I think things like peer-to-peer, sub-metering and all of that sort of stuff, it should all be cool. It sounds like it could work, but I think there's not going to be a big bang in energy, and you're not going to find a Tesla who suddenly, like, tomorrow comes out and it's like, we've reinvented the wheel and it's really cool and sleek and low carbon now. Actually, yeah, this is one big machine. It's not, it's not something that you can disrupt in the same way, and perhaps it's actually up to the energy industry to come up with ways to disrupt itself.
From my perspective, the most interesting things about the wholesale market are probably how it will change in future. So some of those more fundamental market design questions, which will then dictate the kind of data that we have and need. So, you know, where we're in a world with that shorter duration of settlement period, that kind of thing. I suppose what's missing from the wholesale trading data utopia?
You know, the current direction of policy travel in GB, Europe, is that there will be trading of some kind, and we can expect to see this be important. And ultimately, I think that means that this is all going to be done by robots, or to a large
Androids,
extent by robots.
Finally, Androids in the trading desk. I've got the image in my head.
I mean, who is it? It's either Vattenfall or StatCraft have this. They already do it.
Hang on, but we're talking about algo trading here, right? We're not talking about actual, you know, humanoids with sort of personalities and different names coming in, hanging up their hats.
Well, as far as I can tell from trading desks, they'll all be called Tom. it's just a set of algorithmic trading rules. I think that that's probably the future, but my question will be, to what scale will it be done? Will it, you know, will my fridge have its own algorithmic dispatch system, and then will it be trading energy on a 1 second, 1 minute, 5 minute basis? I think that there's definitely a job opportunity in there for a programmer, for regulators to open up traders' black boxes. You'll need to be able to justify why you took a trading decision that you took. I think pointing to your code and going somewhere in there is not going to be good enough. You start getting into these kind of Darwinistic games, right? That people will be writing algorithms to combat other algorithms. And incorporate what you believe your competitors assume about the world into your algorithm so that you can try and trade ahead of them to take advantage of what I believe their behavior is. And you end up in that Darwinian race.
Which is, I mean, that's what markets do fundamentally, right? Like, but it's just with algorithms, it can happen a lot quicker and maybe with some unintended consequences that traders wouldn't necessarily see.
Yeah, and when you're dealing with an asset that is delicate and of vital national importance.
Well, that's the thing, I suppose, yeah. In other trading algorithmic hiccups, maybe it's a higher price. It's
probably fine in oil because you can squeeze
it. Yeah, exactly. It can be stored, it can be squeezed. But electricity, if the outcome is the lights are going out, then different set of risks.
Do you have any conclusions? I guess my conclusion is, A, trading fulfills a really important part of coordination, decision making, and risk management. It's done across... So there's a very kind of centralized set of rules upon which the trading exists. Those centralized rules at the moment probably inhibit much of the cool future stuff we could do. And realistically, the only way I think we're agreed on how you might change that is by kind of sandbox small changes in the short term to create learnings for the long term. And because
I think that's right. I think it's the pace of change and the governance and how we support that. And it's also, I suppose, recognizing the starting point and I suppose the limitations of the wholesale market currently, which are we need to change those, some of those fundamentals, really, to make the whole thing work a lot better.
Trading seems like it's the top level, the thing that drives everything. Actually, it's the emergent behavior of all the other stuff, because you can't really change the trading until you change all the underlying things, like how the retail market works, how metering and settlement works, how balancing works, and how subsidies work. Actually, trading is, even though it looks like it's the most important thing, it's actually the thing that comes out after everything else. And it's going to be... We tried so hard not to talk about market design and the kind of fundamentals, but we failed utterly. And realistically, actually, we might be recording this like the second or third of the topics we've done, but actually we still need to talk about all the other stuff to give you the final conclusion.
Well, the final conclusion, what we think the overall solution for net zero is. That's episode 4 or 5, I'd say. Cool. Thanks.
Right, well, that's been fun.
That has been fun. Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Thank you for listening. And if you would like to get in touch, drop us an email at thesubstationpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter.